Flashback Twin Cities, good morning. I am Tom Osman, hosting an hour of Flashback Twin Cities, and along with me is James. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great. It's bright outside. It is 19, but...
it's, you know what? That's better than zero. I think we've gotten spoiled.
I think we had a couple Saturdays below zero here.
I think I was listening to the radio before. There's only been, I believe, 2 days this winter where it's reached below zero.
I think those are 2 days we came in here.
You might be right.
So I have a quiz for you. First of all, before we do that, I want to remind everyone that what we talk about today is a flashback in media and history through clips and past video, people, and memories of the Twin Cities. And you can check out some of these videos on tcmedianow.com, follow on Facebook at tcmedianow, or Twitter at tcmedianow. Not too bad, huh?
No. Well done. Got it all out there.
Quiz for you.
Oh, shoot.
February 28th, 1983. Where were you?
I was a sparkle in my dad's eye.
There you go. What happened in media on 2/28/1983?
Huh.
I'll give you a hint.
Please do.
121 million people watched this event on February 28th, 1983, which will be 30 years this week.
I have no idea.
Remember a show called MASH?
MASH. All right. I knew it was going to be a TV show.
MASH's final episode aired on 2/28/1983, 30 years ago this week. It was the largest television audience of a TV program for 27 years, only surpassed by the 2010 Super Bowl.
Before that was Mission Impossible. Was that final episode really, really watched as well?
No. In fact, what the episode that was before MASH was the Who Shot JR episode of Dallas.
Ah, all right.
This the last episode of MASH, a 2.5-hour episode, keep in mind, surpassed that on February 28th, 1983. The episode was called Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen, written by a very large collaboration of writers. Alan Alda directed it. He also was one of the writers and, of course, a star. The night that MASH, that's the last episode, was a cultural event. Reading in some of these past articles, streets were empty. People were home. People were glued to the set. And even here in the Twin Cities, there was a lot of buzz, a lot of MASH parties. So granted, you were a twinkle in your dad's eye, but perhaps your dad was at a MASH party that night.
It would not surprise me at all.
Let's take a flashback to 2/28/83. This is on WCCO-TV, the station that carried MASH in its 11-year run. This is Dave Moore introducing a MASH party.
From the outside, there's nothing particularly interesting about Pavex paint products, nor is there anything remarkable about what goes on inside.
That's the Pavex Museum audio, but we have MASH audio also.
According to song, suicide is painless. Those words from the MASH melody would seem to belie themselves tonight. Ironically, the end of MASH came as a suicide. MASH died not at the hands of a ratings-conscious network executive, but rather at the hands of the performers and writers, producers of the show, who voted in favor of its cancellation late last year. MASH's suicide was not painless, but it was thoughtful, a hallmark of the show's 11-year career. Many viewers are spending this night celebrating a decade-old friendship, and Jim Newman is with some of them in St. Louis Park. Jim?
That's right, Dave. Tonight was a landmark night, an event that was nationally shared and of significance, if only because 110 million people took part.
Here in St. Louis Park, it looked like the night of a major military victory in some occupied land. Business-suited civilians celebrated with soldiers in their ragged fatigues. As 7:30 approached, the joking and chatter subsided some as a poignant moment flitted by. For the last time, the camera tilted up and zoomed in on that swarm of vintage choppers. The soundtrack serenaded with the song Suicide is Painless, better known as the MASH theme. Familiar names flashed by, and though the crowd smiled, this was the end of something. The audience here would age, grow old, but Hawkeye and Houlihan and Father Mulcahy will age no longer. They are assured eternal life in the off hours of television time. The show will be missed by civilians and the military.
They were human, and we in the military are human.
What are you going to miss about the show?
The sense of humor of all the people in the situation.
Well, sad. We know there's a lot of reruns of Washington in the future.
The commercials sold for $450,000 a minute and used famous TV stars like Robert Stack. We will see Hawkeye again. Next time, he may be hawking something.
And it was a great night, Pat. Too bad you had to work.
I think Alan Alda actually hawked a computer company. I can't remember what it was, but I think it went broke not long after he started hawking it. No, this is criminal.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. So $450,000 in 1983 would be about $1 million today, actually, according to the inflation calculator.
That is remarkable. That is remarkable.
Higher billing than the Super Bowl that year and higher viewership than the Super Bowl that year.
And I challenge you to think of a more depressing theme song of any TV show.
It is a pretty depressing theme song. I recall when Cheers went off the air almost 20 years ago this year, and they had the same kind of situation. It was Cheers parties, and it was a 3-hour event to the 2-hour episode, and every cover of every magazine had Cheers on it. And this, I think, MASH really kind of set the precedent for big send-offs. You know, most TV shows, as Dave Moore alluded to, they're not suicide. They're actually killed by the network executives in a boardroom. And, you have that what's it called, that jump the shark syndrome?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And if you don't understand what that means, that's when the Fonz went over a leather jacket and skis over a shark. I don't know why the Happy Days cast was in California from Milwaukee, but that's kind of the mark when a TV series has...
That moment where it goes to the point where they've just given up trying to ground it in reality, and they're just going crazy.
And I don't think MASH did that. I was not a huge MASH watcher. There's people close to me who liked it quite a bit. I remember being on a lot, but big moment in TV history that I think it's important to note. Let's listen to one more clip from this night. It was a half hour of news of all MASH, and this is another highlight from that broadcast on 228.83.
The people who keep track of these things at Channel 4 tell us that the ratings for MASH in the Twin Cities generally ran a bit higher than in the nation at large. It was a show, of course, that changed the way we looked at history and also at ourselves. Alan Cox reports.
For 20 years, it did not look like the stuff of comedy. 54,000 Americans died in Korea, and it ended in stalemate. But most Americans weren't ready to question authority. They embraced it, elected a soldier president.
I shall go to Korea.
Russell Tenhoff went to Korea. He's a cook at Fairview Hospital now, but 22 years ago, he was fighting his way up Heartbreak Ridge. A piece of shrapnel cut into his leg. Tenhoff thinks he would have lost it if not for the MASH unit he was carried to. On the operating table, he saw the qualities millions of Americans would see portrayed on TV.
Before I went under, the doctor that was operating on me, he said, it's a shame that these kids are coming in so young, and everything. And they hit a heart, and they didn't like to see us coming in hurt like that, So they were really great people.
Tenhoff likes MASH, so do a lot of people. At a MASH party in St. Paul, Army reservists joined in. An officer said he considers MASH a historical comedy. That's a far cry from the origins of the television series. It premiered in September 1972, 2 years after the movie. The country was deep in another war. This time, unlike Korea, deep in turmoil.
Life after MASH, and as many people probably know, they tried to do with Colonel Potter and Klinger, tried to do after MASH, which didn't do too well. I found out the commercial that Alan Alda hawked, the Atari 800 XL. That was the computer that Alan Alda tried to promote for a couple of years.
He hawked an Atari?
Yeah, I recall, and I thought there was another company too, and I'll have to look this up, but there are about 25 commercials on the internet right now, Alan Alda hawking the Atari 800 XL in 1984, and as you probably have assumed, we aren't using Atari phones. The Atari didn't, they were Pong great, the Atari 800 XL, I'm not sure about that.
Do you think he ever used one? I can't see it. I really can't.
I don't see Hawkeye using Alan Alda using computers at all.
See, you get him confused. He becomes the same person.
Yeah, that's the problem sometimes. This is Flashback Twin Cities, and we're going to have a great guest today. We're going to have Danny Henry from the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting, who's going to talk about what the museum does, what he does, and all it has to offer. This is Flashback Twin Cities. We'll take a break. This is Club 1220 KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities on Club 1220. KLBB, I am Tom Osmond, and with me is my guest, Danny Henry. Welcome.
Hi, Tom. And hi, Tom.
James, sorry.
Hello.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Danny is from the Pavic Museum of Broadcasting, a great organization that I frequent. I'm usually peering in the windows, usually in the morning.
We do see you pretty often.
No, that's to your detriment.
You're that guy.
Yeah, I know. Tell us a little bit about the Pavic Museum, and then talk a little bit about what you do. And we have a lot of audio clips we want to play today.
Sure, yeah. There's plenty of archives to go through. The Pavic Museum of Broadcasting is located in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. And we have one of the largest, if not the largest, collection of antique radios and televisions and broadcast equipment in the world. And it's right here in your own backyard.
A lot of people know about this, but they don't know. I mean, they've heard about it, but they're not really sure what it does, because I think people know about the Broadcast Hall of Fame.
That's correct. Yeah, and that has put us on the map with the preservation of the rich history of broadcasting in Minnesota. And the Hall of Fame is an event that we hold annually. And we nominate, usually there's about 12 people, 12 honorees that go into the Hall of Fame annually.
12 people from Twin Cities Media, and this is on air, and actually on air behind the scenes.
Exactly. It's anyone from radio and television. We even have a few, there's a cameraman in there, there's a few cameramen.
Operators.
Right. Behind the scenes, there's engineers, there's station owners. And then we do also, there's I think even a lawyer, there's an entertainment lawyer in there as well. Yep. So it runs the whole spectrum of the broadcast industry, and it goes back to its infancy.
Well, I'm looking at the list here of people that are in the Hall of Fame. 157 members as of October 2011, and there was not a Hall of Fame event this year, but there's going to be one next year.
Yes, that's correct. This year, 2013, September 29th, and we're still accepting nominations for the Hall of Fame. The deadline is April 1st of this year, and you can actually go to the website museumofbroadcasting.org and nominate someone. 20 years of broadcasting and significant contribution to Minnesota broadcasting. Those are the...
And I did nominate someone, and they got in, and I'm not going to say who that is.
Oh,
but
I didn't know this.
My first nomination I wrote, the gentleman did get in, and it was great to be there and see him get his award.
Can you tell me what year it was? I can figure it out.
It was in 2009.
Oh.
So we'll talk.
I can narrow that down.
We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
So besides the Hall of Fame and besides the antique radios, mm-hmm. you have a lot of different. You have schools that go in there to learn, to take tours and look at the radios and actually create their own broadcasting.
Yeah, that's right. We do a number of educational programs at the museum. Primarily, we do a broadcast workshop, which is the kids come in and. We give them a brief history of electricity, electronic communication. They get to do their own radio show with our studio that's circa 1960, complete with teletype machine for breaking news. And then we also do a mock television show kind of similar to Jeopardy. So that's a bit of reinforcement at the end.
What ages are the kids that come and do this?
Primarily elementary school for the broadcast workshop. We also have a number of other educational programs, though. Electromagnetism, which we can get into a little bit later if you'd like.
Well, tell me what electromagnetism is. I'm not an engineer.
The electromagnetism class is mainly focusing on the science behind electromagnetism. It's such a new program, and to be honest with you, I'm not directly involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have schools coming in for electromagnetism and piggybacking off the broadcast workshop. And the electromagnetism class the range is much wider for the audience, so that can even handle high school age kids.
But if you just – if you're in St. Louis Park or if you're making the trek from Stillwater or St. Paul or Minneapolis, St. Louis Park, you can just come in and take a tour of the museum.
Absolutely, yeah. We are open to the public Wednesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. So you can just stop in. We'll give you a tour. We could show you around. And we also do have a self-guided tour, which we just rolled out last year, as a matter of fact. So you can go at your own pace and walk around with the device and find out more about the museum and the exhibits.
Again, my guest is Danny Henry from the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting. I want to just come back to this school program. I think it's a great thing, and I've been in there when you've had kids in there, and they've seen what. Okay, now you have to help me out. What's that device that you show them how to use? That it's one of the oldest broadcasting tools ever. It's the name I can't think of right now.
The old broadcasting.
Well, it's something with the sound waves.
Are you talking about the tinfoil machine?
That could be it.
Yeah, well, we do have a prototype of Edison's tinfoil machine from 1877, which captured sound, obviously acoustically at that point. But that goes way back to 1877.
We were all sparkles in our parents' eyes at that point, weren't we?
Is that the one where you can speak into, like, it looks like a satellite dish on one side of the room and it... Well, you can hear it at another satellite dish on the other side.
You know, that might you might be thinking of the telephone. But no.
No.
Actually, the tinfoil machine was a prototype of what would become the phonograph record.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, he started with recording on the tinfoil and then switched to wax cylinders later on. And then after that, records became flat and so on and so forth. And we do have a bit of that at the museum as well. We have history of recorded sound. And that's part of the Jack Mullen collection at the museum.
Great. Well, let's take a listen to this. I think this is great because the kids come in and make their own radio show, and this is the first time that the kids' radio show is actually going to be broadcast over the air.
Yeah, yeah. As far as I know, we've never actually played this over the air. Back at the museum, we have, a mock 1960s radio studio, and that broadcast may be half a block, something like that. But, yeah.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome once and again to the crystal clear sounds of KPAV 1200 on your radio dial.
We'll be broadcasting live from the Museum of Broadcasting, home of the history of airwaves.
These are your announcers,
Will
and Sydney from Concord Elementary.
We'll be playing your favorite music today and have the latest weather.
By the way, do you know how horses send messages?
They use horse code! Ha ha ha!
You have been listening to One Fine Day by the Chiffons.
The time is now 12:40, and that means it's time for Catherine, Hannah, Eli, and Sydney. Woo! And more radio history.
I think they might be taking over the show, I think, next week.
I think so, too. Your jobs are in danger.
I know.
They stole
my
best joke.
Yeah.
Well,
the horse code.
I think they took out James' joke book, actually.
And actually, if you listen closely to that clip, you can hear the kids in the background also participating in the TV show, and you can hear them screaming and
they're
rooting their friends on for the quiz show.
I imagine you get a lot of kids that want to be on the air right away when they come in there, and you tell them they're going to be on the radio or TV, and there's probably half the kids that want to be on there, half the kids that are running away from the
microphones. Some of them initially, at least with television, they get kind of nervous. But, you know, after they watch their friends participate in it, and actually after we tell them that the television is just in the museum, they are a little bit more at ease about the whole thing.
That's great. How many school groups do you have going in a year?
You know, in a year we'll see about 3,000 to 4,000 kids.
Wow.
So typically on a weekday, what we would see is maybe 50 to 60 elementary school kids.
Wow.
You know, that's actually stirring memories. Now, we spoke a little bit before the show, and I think I have, in fact, been there in the sixth grade.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And it was fun. It was a really good time. You kind of have to keep on top of the kids, though. They can get a little carried away.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. But they definitely walk away with, and like I said, with the quiz show, you know, it is reinforcement, and whether they know it or not, they did retain, you know, some of the information. And but the great thing about it is that it's hands on, and they're able to get their hands on the equipment and actually participate in the show.
And if you have a child that's not part of a school group going in, are they still able to do one of these programs? Is that something that can still be done, or
sure,
should they organize their Cub Scout or Girl Scout group to do that on their own?
You know, we do encourage to call for larger groups, and mm-hmm. I would think a larger group is maybe anyone over six people.
Sure.
But, and especially if there's another group booked and the studio is being used, but encourage to call ahead. But you can just stop by. Like I said, we're open to the public Wednesday through Saturday.
Let's talk a little bit about what the PAVC, how the PAVC was founded. And I call it a PAVC, sure. But what is the official name of the museum now?
Well, it is the PAVC Museum of Broadcasting. And our namesake is Joe PAVC. And PAVC was a radio collector, and he was actually an amateur radio operator as well. And he was a nuts and bolts salesman from Hopkins, Minnesota. And he traveled throughout the upper Midwest and would go to these small towns and buy out all the radios. In fact, he had a crew cut haircut, and he would stop in at the barbershop and find out, if you ever want to find out anything about anybody in a small town, you go and you get a haircut and you talk to the barber. So he would find out who had the radio in town, and he would go and buy it. And he amassed this collection that's primarily 20s and 30s radios, 1920s and 30s radios. But he's our namesake, and that's why we're there.
It's a lot of Philcos, a lot of RCAs, a lot of...
Exactly. Atwater Kent is another big name.
Well, let's listen to a little clip. This is in 1984 on KSUP News, and Michael Boyle is the host of this segment. A little introduction to Joe PAVC.
From the outside, there's nothing particularly interesting about PAVC's paint products, nor is there anything remarkable about what goes on inside. It's what's down in the basement that's unusual. This auto paint supply store also houses PAVC's Museum of Wonderful Wireless, one of the most awesome and comprehensive collections of early radio equipment in the world. Collected over the last 30 years, the thousands of items in the museum represent the development of radio from its origins in the first decade of the century through the 40s when television arrived. The huge collection was assembled by 75-year-old Joe PAVC, who has an encyclopedic knowledge of the venerable equipment.
A very deluxe set, which is contains AM and the first year of FM, 1941. This particular set was from the L.S. Donaldson estate.
PAVC's museum contains rare examples of over 250 different vintage radio receivers, as well as displays of early tubes and the ornate speakers that were used to deliver the broadcasts. Joe PAVC not only collects the equipment, he spends a lot of time restoring it, often to working order. To do that, PAVC also maintains a huge selection of old radio parts. Many of his receivers pick up today's programs as well as they broadcast yesterday. Another special section is devoted entirely to radios manufactured in Minneapolis, most of them dating from the mid-1920s when about 30 different Twin Cities companies were making receivers.
There are many fell by the wayside that just were in the heyday, and then they were long gone because competition in engineering was too keen and complex.
While radio is the main focus, the museum also has a substantial collection of vintage television sets, including this working 3-incher from 1946, an early projection model, an unusual novelty set with a swiveling screen, and the very first portable television with a round screen.
I feel so strongly that the Twin Cities are electronic cities, that there should be a museum depicting what transpired in this area in communications and development of radio.
PAVC's Museum of Wonderful Wireless is truly one of the significant hidden attractions of the Twin Cities, but Joe PAVC will be happy to give you a tour if you call him in advance. For a look at the gear that gave birth to broadcasting, PAVC's Museum of Wonderful Wireless is a treasure trove. Nipper, are you sure you're listening to me? In Minneapolis, I'm Michael Boyle, your KSTP-TV media commentator.
I should point out that that particular clip is from 1983, maybe 84. It was a piece that KSTP News did on the museum. And the museum was initially in Joe Pavick's basement. He had a paint shop downtown Minneapolis. And he did show it off by appointment only. And the reason I play that audio is because it's actually good to hear Mr. Pavick's voice.
Mm-hmm.
So the museum moved locations, and we actually opened in 1988 in the location that we're at now. So we're in our 25th year. Mr. Pavick lived till about 1989, I believe. So 6 months maybe after the museum was established in its current location. He did pass away, but he was around long enough to see it happen. And it's good to hear his voice.
And Joe Pavick was not a media guy. He was not...
Right. He was an amateur radio operator. He was a ham radio guy.
And
a collector. Yep. And primarily a collector.
Well, his collection, you know, I'm guessing, and I get the same kind of feedback occasionally on some of the things I've collected in the past, videotapes.
Uh-huh.
And like, well, why are you doing this?
why do you do this?
And I'm guessing when people went to Joe's house and saw the basement and like, what are you doing here radios we threw away?
Yeah, yeah. And there was one point, I believe, in the late 70s where he had the whole collection up on the auction block and he was looking to sell it off. And right around that time is where a guy by the name of Earl Bakken stepped in and a guy by the name of Paul Hedberg stepped in and the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. And they helped manage the collection and establish it at the location that it's at today.
This is a good story. This is Danny Henry from the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting. This is Flashback Twin Cities. Earl Bakken and, Mr. Hedberg.
Paul Hedberg,
Talk about these two gentlemen.
Okay, well, Earl Bakken is the inventor of the wireless pacemaker and co-founder of Medtronic. And he has an interest in engineering and radio. And so that's the connection there. And there's also a Bakken Museum and Library in South Minneapolis.
Which is a great museum.
Right. And Paul Hedberg was once the president of the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. And he owns a company called Hedberg Broadcasting, and he lives in Iowa.
Two very instrumental men of the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting.
Absolutely.
And the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and we wouldn't be there without any of those people.
Also, you wouldn't be here without the support of the community. And people can give to the museum also, correct?
Yes, that's correct. We are all privately funded. And we do have sponsorships available, and you can find out more information about that at the museum website, which is museumofbroadcasting.org.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to play some more audio. We have some audio from the original KLBB with some notable names, and also one of our KLBB on-air hosts.
I think you're going to recognize some of these voices.
Part of the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
So this is Flashback Twin Cities on Club 1220 KLBB.